Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Big Boss Man.
Yes.
Can't you hear me when I call?
The race to the top to be the big boss man at Goldman Sachs. David Solomon chosen as the one to eventually succeed Lloyd Blankfein as CEO. Let's get more on this Goldman successor story that continues to be among the most read on the Bloomberg since it came out last week. Dakin Campbell is financial reporter at Bloomberg News in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. And joining Dakin is Allison Williams, senior financial research analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. She joins us from our BI headquarters in Princeton. Dakin, let's start with you. I kind of laughed coming in and I'm like, oh my God, we have all been obsessed with this story. But Goldman is an important firm in the financial community.
Yes, that's right. And any successor to Lloyd Blankfein is of interest to people. I mean, he's been running Goldman for 12 years. That's longer than just about everybody but Jamie Dimon on Wall Street. So yeah. A change at the top of Goldman would be new, and people are interested in who the new guy is.
Well, let's talk about this new guy. Who is he and what do we know about him?
Yeah, so this is David Solomon. He's now the number two to Blankfein, and when Blankfein finally decides to step aside, which we don't know when that will be, but when he does, David is the guy. David's a longtime investment banker. He joined Goldman as a partner from Bear Stearns in 99, I believe, came up through leveraged finance, and then he ran Goldman's investment banking division for over a decade until he got this position. I think it was announced December 2016.
So, Allison, this is a guy who's certainly well-known internally to the folks at Goldman and well-known to Wall Street.
He is, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about his banking background. You know, Lloyd sort of had come up through a trader, but I think, you know, if you look at the firm, all parts of the firm have prospered under Lloyd. In fact, some might argue that the trading has been the weaker part, although certainly that's due to a lot of the regulatory challenges, a lot of the secular challenges. But I think that, just taking a step back, when you look at Goldman, just the continuity of a very strong and consistent culture, the focus on risk management, the focus on technology are two things that they talk about. They're things that have helped them be successful, and I think that consistent culture is something that gives investors a fair amount of comfort that sort of mitigates the succession risk.
Right, and you certainly see it in the share price. I'm just taking a look at the last 3 days or since all this news started percolating. And the shares have moved higher on each day, and they're up about 1.2%. I mean, Dakin, what does this mean? What's going to change at Goldman under somebody like Solomon versus Lloyd Blankfein?
I think from all I can understand from people I'm talking to at this point, Solomon will be charged with continuing what's already been put in place. So you may remember in September, Harvey Schwartz, of all people, presented Goldman's growth plan, $5 billion across a number of initiatives over the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. So this is a firm that for years, you know, husbanded capital, really cut costs and didn't think together as a firm about generating revenue. Now they are in a growth mindset. And so as Lloyd steps aside, David Solomon will be the guy that sort of will be expected to generate growth at Goldman.
Allison, come on in, because you know, you look at, just like Dakin, you look at Goldman, you look at all the, of its competitors. What will be kind of the key challenges for Goldman going forward?
I think the key challenge is really going to be, you know, I guess deciding how big they're going to be in terms of this consumer effort, this online effort. I think that's been the main deviation. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, the two big things that happened under Lloyd, one of which he had no control over, was, you know, sort of the change in regulation. And again, that will probably be something that will be key under Solomon. You know, will that sort of take a step back? And so it was sort of a challenge for Lloyd, but could be sort of a tailwind for Solomon. But and, you know, and then in terms of direction of the firm, looking at this consumer business and going to retail, that was, I think, the, you know, sort of the biggest change for Goldman. Obviously, it's a very small part of this business. It's incremental. But how big will that be? And then just in terms of timing, I think, the interesting thing to note is there's a lot of talk about why now.
Right.
I think if you think about when Lloyd stepped in, so that was sort of mid-2006, he was sort of he came in sort of late in the cycle. He helped to, you know, perhaps prepare the firm for the downturn that was coming, even though, you know, it was a while before things sort of cracked in the environment. But again, you don't want to, I think, make those transitions, you know, during a time of tumult or during a time of, you know, bad economy. So, you know, if you look at sort of the timing, he came in, he helped guide the firm through the crisis, and then, you know, has led the firm through this many year-long bull market, and now perhaps Solomon, you know, stepping in and getting into place ahead of, you know, potentially the next downturn.
Just got about 20 seconds left, Dakin.
Yeah, I think when we talk about Goldman, at least me and the people I talk to, we talk about trading versus investment banking. Lloyd was a trader, mm-hmm. and he oversaw great, huge profits in trading. Harvey Schwartz was his CFO in terms of figuring out that business and bringing in big deals. David Solomon is an investment banker, so he's sort of bringing Goldman maybe back to the investment banking days of Hank Paulson and John Weinberg and those folks.
Dakin Campbell of Bloomberg News, Allison Williams of Bloomberg Intelligence, right here on Bloomberg Radio. The Healthy Nevada Project is a community-based population health study launched in 2016, uses genetic, clinical, environmental, and socioeconomic data to really understand the relationship between those factors and their effects on overall health. Let's get more with Jim Metcalf. He's chief data scientist at the Healthy Nevada Project, on the phone from Reno. Jim, nice to have you here on this Monday. I did the basics, but tell us a little bit more about what you guys are doing at the Healthy Nevada Project.
Sure. This is a first of its kind initiative between renowned health, local health care provider here in Reno, the Desert Research Institute that has literally decades of environmental data, the Nevada Governor's Office of Economic Development, and genomics company Helix. As you said, we launched the project in 2016 with a pilot project of 10,000, and incredibly, the pilot phase enrolled 10,000 participants in just 48 hours. So there's a lot of interest in this area and a lot of excitement in the state over being on such a cutting-edge project like this.
All right, so 10,000 participants, you said, in the first hour. You've been a couple years into, it sounds like, this project. Tell me what you're finding out. That's an awful lot of data. And you've obviously, I think you're working with SAS, which is based in North Carolina, a big
yes.
software company. Tell me how they're helping you kind of go through the data.
Sure. So a simple example, Reno has forest fires in the summer. We have temperature inversions in the winter, both of which are bad for cardiopulmonary health. But how bad? Statistical modeling combining air quality data from the EPA and from hospital admissions suggests there are large effects on the healthcare system from these kinds of sentinel bad air events. We're seeing in some instances that there is a doubling of impact on the healthcare system when we get a forest fire. And so the question is there a genetic component for someone to have a propensity to go to the hospital after they breathe in the smoke from a forest fire? SAS software is being used to combine all of those data. So we're looking at the environmental data combined with the daily count for people who present at the ED with problems trying to breathe. Then ultimately we'll work the DNA component into that as we begin to process that.
All right. So it's interesting. So you're trying to find out if somebody is going to be more susceptible to maybe a certain environmental condition and maybe hopefully be preemptive in terms of care or put them out of harm's way?
Quite possibly. Imagine having a system where we know that somebody might react badly, and we send them a text saying, don't go outside because it's going to be a bad air day tomorrow. And we know that they're more prone to react to that.
It's interesting. I have to tell you, when I was reading through and getting ready to talk with you, my one concern was, and I feel like this, especially so whenever it involves DNA data, that could be used and abused. As people get to know more about that and it's tapped into or put into kind of a healthcare database, tell me what about the privacy concerns? How do you protect that data?
Sure. So that's probably the topmost concern that we have. And we have processes in place. We have audits in place. We have logging. We're a business associate of the hospital, which is a HIPAA requirement. And we're working with our partner Helix, who also has appropriate protections in place. And so there really is nothing that's connected other than a number for that. So the privacy concerns are being addressed.
Okay, but eventually, right? I mean, if you're hoping to notify people like don't go outside or something, there obviously is a direct digital link back to somebody based on their data.
Sure. So there's processes in place for that, too. There's a group called the Institutional Review Board that would have to review all of that. So we're quite careful when it comes to things like that.
What's the goal of this mission, this project?
Sure. So what we'd like to be able to do is do some great science and improve the population health of the state. Nevada ranks near the bottom compared to the rest of the U.S. in terms of public health funding, research, and health outcomes. For example, people die earlier in Nevada from pancreatic cancer than the rest of the U.S., and the rate of drug-induced deaths is 7 times the national average. We think that we can help change that. Working closely with towns throughout the state, our program hopes to convert data into evidence-based plans to address healthcare priorities to meet these specific community needs.
You mentioned, I think you've got about 50,000 Nevadans. You said 10,000 signed up right away, but I think just looking at some research that you've got about 50,000. How many people do you really need? I mean, the goal is to get everybody signed up. Just got about 20 seconds left here.
Sure. So this Thursday, Brian Sandoval, the governor of the state, is going to announce a kickoff of an additional 40,000 Nevadans to have their DNA studied.
All right. Interesting. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Say, ultimately, we'd like to get to 500,000 if possible.
All right, interesting. And it'd be also fascinating to see kind of how it changes maybe their health care or how it makes eventually the people of Nevada healthier. Jim, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Jim Metcalf is Chief Data Scientist at the Healthy Nevada Project, joining us on the phone from Reno, Nevada.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Ah, yes, indeed. She does, he does. We all do work hard for our money. And when it comes to investing, we want smart ideas. Jeannie Wyatt has some thoughts. Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer at South Texas Money Management. Roughly $3.5 billion in assets under management. Joining us on the phone from San Antonio, Texas. And I know you do have some specific names that you find interesting, Jeannie, at this point. But I also, looking at your research, you don't like Bitcoin, but you do like stocks. What do you make of the conversation? An ongoing conversation, looking at Bitcoin, blockchain, all that good stuff.
Well, it's an interesting conversation, but you know, we have a price chart of an asset class, and we ask people, what asset class do you think this is? Long-term price charts of several different asset classes, and basically it's going sideways, very, very volatile, and the answer is it's currencies. So whether Bitcoin is your currency or another cryptocurrency, currencies long-term are not great investments. They're volatile. They tend long-term to be trendless. So the cryptocurrencies, and there's several of them, their price performance on the upside and the downside has been very, very similar. And so, you know, your timing has to be right. You know, your timing has to be right, getting in and getting out. And so we feel that the broad market common stocks are a better bet.
All right. So, but your clients are asking you about it.
Oh, yes. I think everyone's clients are asking them about it. And, you know, we're not being naysayers that a cryptocurrency or cryptocurrencies are not legitimate. It's very preliminary. And again, just fundamentally, you get more yield, and we think long-term better returns in the stock market.
All right, so let's talk about the stock market. We were mentioning at the top of our broadcast, you know, whoa, what a big kind of bounce back in stocks after a volatile start to the year, where we saw quite a rally and then we saw quite a sell-off, you know,
right.
An actual 10% correction. Right now you've got tech stocks. The NASDAQ is up about 10% on the year. You've got the S&P 500 also higher on the year, now up about 4%. And the Dow, I think we're looking at a gain. Let me just check here on the Bloomberg, up almost 2%. So we've seen a bounce back.
Right.
When you look at names, you like some plain old vanilla names, like a Kroger in the supermarket section, which has been beaten up. They're facing a lot of competition from the likes of Amazon and others. Stock's down 12%, and Kroger just delivered a weak earnings forecast last week. Why do you like it?
Yes. Because we buy, it's very important to have this context, we buy both value stocks and accelerating growth stocks. So we buy stocks that are very cheap, you know, very low valuations, good dividend yields, low price to cash flow, low PEs, as well as growth stocks where they're typically very highly valued, very high PEs, maybe no dividend. And the reason we put together both value and growth stocks are because they are very, very consistent hedges to one another. Value stocks tend to have their own cycle, and growth cycles have their own cycle. And fortunately, they're counter-cyclical, whether it's in a quarter, a year, or a month. And whether you're buying large, mid, small cap, or even international stocks, you've always had that long-term relationship. So like last year clearly was a growth year. Very narrow growth year with just, you know, the fangs, the famous fangs pushing the market. But the year before, 2016, was a value market where value outperformed. And so they tend to go back and forth. So timing when to get in and value and when to get into growth would be impossible, like market timing is impossible. So we blend the two together. We have, what we call very, very ugly stocks.
Let me just ask you, Jeannie, because I'm looking at, you know, Kroger last year was down almost 21%. The year before it was down 17%. I get buying it for the dividend, but in a space where we're not quite sure who's going to be the winners, and that supermarket business is such a low margin business. I understand that it's been beaten up. It's maybe potentially a great value play, but does it make you a little bit nervous about the bigger, broader story that's going on with supermarkets?
No. It is, and again, we haven't been putting new money into Kroger for very long, and you can kind of tell when a stock is out of favor because the stock keeps discounting the same old news. And their recent earnings report at Kroger actually was above consensus. And again, the balance
but their forecast was below consensus.
Right, but they're being very conservative. The street's being very conservative. You know, in all of the staple sector, the grocery sector, or, you know, those companies that are supposed to hold up in very volatile, weak markets, all of the stocks in that space are very expensive. But Kroger, at about a 10 times multiple of this year's earnings, again, a very, you know, strong balance sheet, a nice dividend yield, and trading at only 5 times cash flow.
Right.
Cash flow on value stocks is so critical. And this company has a lot of cash flow and a projected increase in cash flow. And to be trading at a multiple, it is very, very out of favor. So we know value stocks, and that's kind of the profile of value stocks. They, you know, there's all these worries, and then there'll be a catalyst.
Right.
This stock might go down to sideways for a long time. But value stocks, when there's that catalyst, maybe a boost in their operating margin or, an acquisition or something that starts working. And when a company has this much cash flow, there's a lot of safety. There's a lot of safety in that. So the upside on deep value stocks tends to come quickly and be above average. So Kroger's, no question, a deep value stock.
All right, we got to run. Good to check in with you. Jeannie Wyatt, she's Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer at South Texas Money Management, roughly $3.5 billion in assets under management. Jeannie joining us on the phone from San Antonio, Texas. If you're you're someone hoping to be driving a Tesla Model 3, you hope to be on a road where you are driving a Model 3 very soon. But as you know, production problems mean people are still waiting and waiting and waiting. And that's led to some Tesla stalkers. Let's talk about this story. Love it, love it, love it. Tom Randall is Deputy Sustainability Editor here at Bloomberg News. He joins us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. First of all, what's going on? Tesla stalkers? This isn't like stalking Elon, but they're stalking Model 3s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've covered Tesla for a while now, and so I've grown used to a little bit of like super fandom out there. But this is, it's reached a point where it's kind of unreal. You know, investors and short sellers and, you know, fans and reservation holders, they're all trying to figure out when Tesla is going to be able to start producing the Model 3 in numbers that they have said that they are going to. And what it's done is people are going to outrageous lengths to try and figure out where things are at. They are unleashing drones outside of the factory in Fremont, California, you know, pouring over satellite data. You know, you've got, you know, legions of people online on Reddit and Tesla, various forums for Tesla that, you know, they're counting every single vehicle identification number that is being spotted out in the wild to try to estimate where things are at.
I love it. It's like what investors, hedge fund guys do to try and figure out what's going on in China, right? They're counting the electricity usage and all that things. I mean, this is what people are doing to kind of get an idea of the production levels at Tesla.
Yep.
Yeah. We too have come up with our own model, right?
Yeah.
Or you guys have.
Yep. Here at Bloomberg, we created our own model. And our model is based on vehicle identification numbers. You know, these are unique strings of numbers that are assigned to every new vehicle that's produced in the United States. And we have two data sets. One is, you know, Tesla, car companies, before they start production on cars, they have to register big batches of these VINs with safety regulators. So we figured out a way to ping safety regulators and see exactly how many registered VINs they have at any given time. And then separately, we've created kind of a crowdsourced database where we began with what has already been done on social media online and took all of those VINs. And then we also started having owners report their VINs directly to us. And so we've been plotting those out. And we created a model based on those two data sets to kind of guess at how many cars have been produced at any given time or how many they're producing per week.
And what do you guys come up with?
Well, so far they've had a rough time. You know, they're still in production hell, as Elon Musk would say. And in February, you know, one very interesting thing is in February, toward late February, we saw production fall pretty hard.
Yeah.
Which is unusual during a production ramp. And we weren't quite sure what was going on with the model. Well, just yesterday, Bloomberg got confirmation from Tesla that Tesla had shut down the factory for about a week to do some upgrades on some machinery in the Fremont car factory. So our model was able to pick that up. So we'll see. We don't know until the end of the quarter how accurate our model is going to end up being. But
I feel like it's become a joke, not joke, you know, with Elon Musk coming out and saying, hey, folks, this is going to be our production levels. And then he comes out a few months later and says, well, maybe not so much. But investors kind of take it in stride, and so do potential car owners. You talk about Ross Gerber, who's been a frequent guest on Bloomberg Radio. I mean, he's the guy who's been sending out drones, right?
No, he hasn't sent out drones, but, you know, he runs a wealth management fund. They have about $10 million. In Tesla stock. So he is, you know, he has his own reservation. He says he's checking his email multiple times a day just to look for that message from Tesla. But he's also been sending his employees out to delivery lots in Marina Del Rey in California to count cars. You know, he's been surveying people online, you know, to see whose reservation number has come up and done these sorts of things.
So he owns a bunch of Tesla shares.
That's right. That's right.
$10 million.
$10 million, yep.
So he wants to really know what's going on. Yeah, he wants the truth.
He and his investors, yeah.
What are some other stalkers doing?
You know, one of my favorite is Bozzy Tatarovic. He's kind of a car parts savant online. You know, he will tear cars down and find, you know, what cars use the same parts for, you know really obscure niche components of the cars. And so he started looking into Tesla's import data for various parts that they outsource. So specifically, he looked at, you know, wheel covers and 12-volt batteries that are specific to the Model 3. And back in early December, he realized realized, you know, at that point that Tesla had an issue because he, you know, as he said, that if you've only brought in 2,000 of a part that's needed for a car, you can't be making more than 2,000 cars right. until you import more. So
it's akin to like talking to the Apple suppliers, right, to get an idea of like how much demand that they're asking for,
right.
for different component pieces. So net, is there any kind of takeaway from all of this?
Well, you know, Tesla's, this is an absolutely existential issue for Tesla. It has to get Model 3 production going. You know, it spent about $3.5 billion last year getting ready for this moment. And, you know, it has 500,000 people with reservations who are waiting for these cars. So, you know, it has what no other car maker has, which is, you know, this kind of insane desire, insane kind of natural hype. But they've got to be able to build these cars.
Especially when you see, was it the International Auto Show last week, when you have Porsche and others really coming out with some new EV models. Tom Randall, great story. I put some stuff out on Twitter at Carol Mass. Everybody, check it out.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, say you crazy.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed, everybody. Time for the Drive to the Close on this Monday afternoon. Registered investment advisor Alan Lance, director of research at LanceGlobal.com, president of Alan B. Lance & Associates, joining us on the phone from Toledo, Ohio. Alan, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Carol. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's a Monday, trying to get through. Interesting market. We had a nice, or bullish, I should say, rally in stocks last week. Today, we're kind of bouncing around a little bit. I feel like, you know, we're in the middle of earnings, waiting for the next round, and so on. What is your thoughts on this overall market environment right now?
Well, it seems like a lot of give and take. You know, one week, you know, investors are looking at the glass half empty and are worried about inflation and tariffs and a trade war, and you're able to pick up some good quality you know, bargains, and then you have a week like last week, especially near the end and the opening today, where you know, taking some money off the table, where things might get a little ahead of themselves. So I think everything's condensed, you know, week to week, where we used to have months and quarters of these kind of moves. We're starting to get that volatility back in both directions, where the last few years it was just on the upside. So
yeah.
So I think it presents some opportunities.
Well, let's talk about that, because when you guys kicked into the new year, just looking at your research, your long short portfolio was 96% long, 4% cash. And from what I understand, you guys reduced some of your cash, right? Kind of buying into some of the weakness?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a situation where some good quality companies, you know, moved down, and we took advantage of finally having a correction of 10%. It's been a few years since we had that, and that's what you're supposed to do, is buy, you know, in the weakness. And some of the things we talked about, sectors like energy, you know, a few months back, did particularly well last month. So we started taking profits in that area. So it's been a give and take, depending on what sector you're in, and I think that's what the investor has to do. They have to be more proactive and not react to the market, but take advantage of these swings instead of being played by them.
Well, let's drill down into that a little bit. No pun, forgive me, about the energy. But so you guys have been selling off some of your energy names?
Yeah, I mean, Schlumberger, which we talked about a few mm-hmm. months ago, you know, moved from this low 60s to, you know, close to $80 last month. So taking some profit as it reached or was approaching its old highs, you know, made some sense. We haven't bought it back, but it hit 63 last week, so that's
right.
Probably been a good entry point. But yeah. We weren't smart enough to buy it at that level. But again, in the low 60s or below, I think long term you're not going to go wrong with a company like Schlumberger, and take advantage of those swings, you know, as much as you can.
Well, it's interesting too. Telecom is another area that you, from what I understand, have been, I guess, were one of your biggest new purchases over the past few months. But have you been pulling back a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, Verizon and AT&T have done really well. We still like CenturyLink, CTL, from the standpoint it really hasn't done anything for a number of years, and it has a decent dividend. So I think, and there's some foreign telecoms that we like. So that's going to be more a collective group, not buying the overall sector like with energy.
So help me out here. So you said that you were putting more cash to work on some of the dips. Where did you commit new money that you're still holding on to and that you will for some time?
Yeah, the utilities. I mean, they've been getting decimated with worries of higher interest rates, and you have companies like Scana that has gone from $75 a year ago to in the 30s, and even Edison International that was as far as over $80 a share, and we picked up some last week in the high 50s. Good yields because the stocks have dropped off so much. Low expectations, we like that. Just like energy this summer had lower expectations, and we're kind of the forgotten sector. I think utilities are going to surprise investors, on the upside, and not have that much risk because the expectations are so low. So that's one of the sectors that we're adding to into new lows here, like we did with energies, 6-9 months ago.
Alan, remind all of our listeners too that kind of your strategy and what you're looking for. I mean, what are some of the things that you're looking for that to decide whether or not to kind of buy into a new name?
Well, I learned under Sir John Templeton, so we're value conscious, but it's not just a matter of value. We'll go with growth. I mean, some of our largest positions are Apple and Google, so it's not a situation where we're just looking at undervalued names, but more so on a relative basis, buying when a sector's or a company's out of favor, looking at the risk reward of 3 to 4 to 1, and then always managing the risk. So if we do make a mistake, try to get out early enough and redeploy the money and into something else that might be a better idea.
Is GE something that you like right now? Just got about 20 seconds, real quickly.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we haven't pulled the trigger. We own some of the preferreds when it was down in the teens at 25 par. But on the common, I would be careful. But if it went down further, it might be something attractive for the long term.
All right, good to check in with you. Right now, shares of GE selling at $15.13 a share. Stock is down about 13% this year. Alan Lance, thank you so much. Director of Research at LanceGlobal.com, president of Alan B. Lance & Associates, joining us on this Monday from Toledo, Ohio. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.